The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we don't see
them. We still, to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast.
Remember, I used to give you lessons too. Go on, let me hear you play something.
Welcome to a special edition of the Zero Books podcast. Ashley Frawley is a member of the Zero Books team, and this week she is the host of the podcast. Frawley, being interested in Marx's crisis theory, interviewed Professor Rick Kuhn, who has spent over 20 years studying the Marxist economist Heinrich Grossmann. And in this episode, Frawley and Kuhn discuss the declining rate of profit, countervailing tendencies against that declining rate of profit, the Frankfurt School, and the cultural turn. It's Wednesday, February 27th, 2019, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the regular host of the podcast. This week's podcast is available in full. Our Patreon supporters get access to two podcasts every week, Symptomatic Redness and Zero Squared. But if you're listening on our free feed, you'll always be able to access one or the other each week. I hope you enjoy them. The music you're listening to right now is Chico and Harpo playing the piano in the film The Big Store. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Ashley Frawley discuss Heinrich Grossmann's Crisis.
My name is Ashley Frawley. I am a sociologist, and I dabble a tiny little bit in Marxian economics. And so I've really loved I've loved the work of Heinrich Grossmann, and I really enjoyed the papers that you've written on that topic. And generally, I'm interested in sort of crisis and breakdown and so on. So I'm really, really pleased that you've agreed to talk to me.
It's a pleasure.
I'm going to introduce you. Rick Kuhn is a Marxian economist from Australia and reader at the Australian National University in Canberra. He's the author of a number of books, including Labour's Conflict, Big Business, Workers, and the Political Class and Struggle in Australia, and a number of books on the life and work of Marxist economist and historian Heinrich Grossmann. Hi, Rick, and thank you for joining me this morning and this evening in Australia.
You're welcome. I'm now an honorary associate professor in sociology. I've retired.
So doubly thanks for joining me rather than bird watching or doing all the more interesting things that I'm sure there are to do. I'm really interested in your work on Heinrich Grossmann and as well as the rest of your work, which we can come to. But I was wondering kind of what got you interested in his research and his story. Looking at the sort of body of work that you've put together, it looks like an immense labor of love. What got you interested in doing this, and what's involved in this kind of work?
Well, in the first instance, it was a very good essay by Anwar Sheikh, published in 1979 in a Union of Radical Political Economists reader called History of Marxist Crisis Theory. It's available free on the web now, an excellent essay, and Anwar Sheikh really vindicated Grossmann's position as against underconsumptionist and disproportionality theories of economic crisis. So that got me interested in the 1980s. In the late 1980s, the Berlin Wall came down, and I decided that I would learn German. I'd heard it as a child, but my parents, who came from Vienna as kids themselves with their parents to Australia, they didn't speak German to me. They spoke it with their parents. So I decided to learn German and did so while teaching at the Australian National University. And then once I had developed some competence, not a vast competence, but some competence in German in the 1990s, I embarked on some research on Grossman, remembering and the essay by Anwar Sheikh, which I also used in my teaching. So that was what set me off. And once I got into it, there was a certain aspect that was sort of like family history. Not that I had any relationship with Henry Grossman, not that I know about, but he originally came from a part of the world that my mother's family came from. Well, he came from Western Galicia. He was born in Krakow, which is now in Poland. Galicia was the Austro-Hungarian Polish province, because at that stage, well, really from the late 18th century, Poland didn't exist as a separate state. And part of Poland, Galicia, was under Austro-Hungarian rule. And there was a significant Jewish minority in Eastern Galicia, but also in Western Galicia, where Grossman grew up and was educated. So the research I did on Grossman developed some skills that led me to be able to trace back some of my mother's antecedents as well. So being of Jewish extraction like Grossman, being a Marxist like Grossman, having some connection with that particular corner of Eastern Europe, got me even more interested in tracing his life and reinforced my interest in getting to know his approach to Marxist economic theory even better. And that greater knowledge has increased a respect that was already engendered into me by reading Anwar Sheikh's essay. Grossman became politically active in the Polish Social Democratic Party of Galicia, but he took on a leading role in organizing Jewish workers in Galicia, a group which the PPSD largely ignored except in the lead up to elections. And that was true of those PPSD leaders who were themselves Jewish. Grossman took it upon himself, along with some other university students at the Jagiellonian University in Krakow, to begin to organise Jewish workers, and had a considerable degree of success in doing so, and in the process turned himself into what Gramsci calls an organic intellectual of the working class, and helped generate organic intellectuals, the working class, from the other direction, that is, out of talented workers, trade unionists. Eventually, Grossman was the founding secretary of an organisation that split from the PPSD, the Jewish Social Democratic Party of Galicia, which around its formation in 1905 had about 2,000 members, which is quite impressive. The organisation immediately applied for membership of the Federal Austrian Social Democratic Party, which was denied by the leadership, which was largely from the German Austrian Party based in Vienna. So I developed skills in the process of undertaking this research, which included visits to archives in Australia, believe it or not, because somebody who knew Grossman well was an Australian-born novelist called Christina Stead, and she fictionalised him in some works and also took notes about him that were quite valuable. And archives on the west coast and the east coast of the United States, in Poland and in Germany. I also developed some basic proficiency in Yiddish, not so much to speak it, but to be able to read Yiddish as well, because those workers that Grossman was involved in organising in Galicia were overwhelmingly Yiddish-speaking people.
That's an incredible amount of work, it seems to me. How long have you been doing this?
when did I begin? About 1995? Yeah, I claim to be an expert on Henrik Grossman, but I don't know that that's a massive claim, given that poor old Henrik is not as well known as I think he should be.
The more that I was reading your work and the more that I was reading about what he said, the more I thought the fact that we don't know very much about him, I think that says a lot about our moment today on the left, because he had some incredibly important insights that, if he was correct, are, you know, fundamental to our understanding of economics, of political organizing, of what we should do and what the future holds. And nobody knows who he was.
People who are interested in Eastern European Jewish history, and particularly the history of the Bund, know a bit about him. The Jewish Social Democratic Party was politically close to the Bund, which was, well, it was the largest revolutionary organisation, the largest Marxist organisation in the Russian Empire up until 1906, and it was an inspiration to the leaders of the Jewish Social Democratic Party, and for that matter, the rank and file. So people who are interested in the Bund might have heard of him, and then he is still remembered as a Marxist economist, but he is portrayed, largely because of the work of Paul Sweezy, I think, as somebody who had a thoroughly mechanical conception of capitalism's breakdown, a characterization that I think is very inaccurate. Grossman was the first person to take seriously Marx's theory of economic breakdown and economic crisis based on the tendency of the rate of profit to fall. He worked out a position on that in the early 1920s on the basis of his analysis of Otto Bauer's reproduction schemes, which in turn were based on Marx's reproduction schemes in the second volume of Capital. And that analysis, Grossman's analysis and recuperation of Marx's account of economic crisis and capitalism's tendency to break down, came to fruition in Grossman's 1929, The Law of Accumulation and Breakdown of the Capitalist System. At the moment, I'm working on editing the first unabridged translation of that book. It was published in an abridged version in the early 1990s. Gyrus Banerjee and I have done a translation which I am now editing in some detail, and for which I will write an introduction, hopefully well before the end of this year. Grossman's approach to breakdown and crisis was that in order to compete with their rivals, capitalists invest an increasing proportion of their outlays, of their capital, in constant capital, that is, in machinery, equipment, buildings, because if they outlay more, especially on new technology, that increases the efficiency of production. It can lead to a cheapening of the price, understood in terms of the amount of labour that goes into creating a commodity, can lead to a cheapening of the price of commodities, and therefore those who innovate can steal a march on their rivals. The thing, though, about this competitive accumulation, which is characteristic of capitalism, is that in itself it leads to economic crisis. Why is that the case? Because Marx's economic theory is based on his labour theory of value, a labour theory of value which drew on, but is distinct from, earlier labour theories of value propounded by classical economists, most outstandingly by Adam Smith and David Ricardo. And the basic idea is that that prices bear a systematic relationship with the amount of labour that goes into producing commodities. They're not, prices aren't, Marx argued, identical to the amount of labor that goes into producing a commodity, but price is systematically related to the amount of labor that goes into producing commodities. Back to the crisis theory. If you're outlaying more on constant capital and less on living labor, what you're doing is reducing that proportion of the capitalist outlays that actually creates new value. That is, the outlays on purchasing the capacity to work, workers, labor power, as opposed to machinery and equipment, tools and so on, which do not create new value. What they do is simply pass on the value that's already embodied in them. And as this process of accumulation continues, the new value-creating proportion of capitalist outlays declines in relationship to the outlays on constant capital. What is profit? Profit is a measure of the newly created value, newly created by the productive element, the creative element in the production process, that is, the expenditure of labour by workers, compared with not only what has been paid to the workers for their labour power, that is, their wages, but also what is outlaid on constant capital. And if the wage bit declines in its ratio with the constant capital bit, then there will be a tendency for the rate of profit to fall, other things being equal, other things including the rate of exploitation or the rate of surplus value, that is, how much of the labour that is squeezed out of workers every day at the workplace, how much the boss appropriates and how much goes to the worker in wages. So that's the underlying tendency that Marx identifies in the third volume of Capital that Grossman also highlights. Now, if that was the end of the story, then why the fuck is capitalism still around? Because the rate of profit would have continuously fallen, and the incentive for bosses to invest, to accumulate, to keep the system going, would have long ago disappeared. Marx identified a series of counter tendencies to the tendency for the rate of profit to fall in the third volume of Capital. Grossman elaborates on these and adds some further counter tendencies in his Law of Accumulation book. The counter tendencies include increasing the rate of surplus value, although a worker cannot work 100% of her working day for the boss and no percent for herself, because if that's the case, she will starve to death. So there is a limit on the increase in the rate of surplus value or the rate of exploitation. The production process itself, the process of accumulation itself, in cheapening commodities, that is the weapon that bosses use in competition with each other, or one of the key weapons that they use in competition with each other, that, of course, over time cheapens a whole range of commodities, including those commodities that workers require to reproduce themselves, that is, what they spend their wages on. So as food and clothing, housing get relatively cheaper because they are produced more efficiently because they have improved technology is used to create them, that can mean that the value embodied in the wage can be pushed down while the actual things that workers consume remain the same. They eat the same amount, they have the same number of shirts and skirts and trousers and so on. And even living standards can improve while the value of labour power declines. That is, the amount of labour that is required to reproduce the worker declines because of improvements in technology. So that's another mechanism that tends to slow down the tendency for the rate of profit to fall, to counteract it at least for a period. Another one is that there is a cheapening of the items that go to make up constant capital. The machinery and equipment is produced more cheaply itself. Another counter tendency. Opening up new areas for capital investment abroad or new branches of technology can also counteract the tendency for the rate of profit to fall. A process of unequal exchange between more backward and more advanced economies can suck surplus value out of the backward ones and transfer it to the more advanced ones. Another counter tendency. And there are a number of others. So Rossman talks about this as well as the underlying tendency for the rate of profit to fall. But what he maintained and what Marx also argued that in the longer term, the tendency for the rate of profit to fall prevails and generates economic crises. But economic crises themselves can counteract the tendency for the rate of profit to fall, because in the course of economic crises, some capital is devalued. That is, some bosses or corporations go out of business, they sell off their means of production at a discount, and those who purchase it can therefore have a higher rate of profit than the now bankrupt bosses had on the outlays that they had made, at a higher price than is paid by the capitalists who have bought up this bankrupted capital on the cheap. And also, economic crises destroy value as well. Some of the means of production of bankrupted corporations or firms just ceases to be used at all, and therefore doesn't figure anymore in the calculations of the overall rate of profit in a society. So economic crises themselves establish a basis for renewed accumulation. Now, it could be argued that, well, this approach is still mechanical. Really, if we're just talking about purely economic mechanisms, then this is a mechanical theory. But actually,
What does a mechanical theory mean? What does that criticism try to get at?
It gets at the idea that there's no human agency involved.
Hmm.
The capitalism will break down of its own accord, and the implication is that there is no need for working class organisation or struggle, because capitalism will break down of itself.
Yeah, but isn't Grossman still accused of that, or wasn't that a sort of widespread criticism of his work?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, he is accused of that. And it just doesn't fit with his politics or with his economic analysis. In terms of his politics, Grossman was an economic activist, a political activist in Krakow when he was in Galicia. After the First World War, he was living in Vienna and had a reasonably senior job at the Austrian Statistical Agency lined up when the coalition government that followed the First World War deemed Jews who had come from Galicia within a certain period of time to be Polish and to have no right to stay in Austria. It might be mentioned that that coalition government, at the stage that that war was passed, was led by the Austrian Social Democrats. So Grossman was deemed to be a Pole, and he moved to Warsaw, where he got a job with the Polish Central Statistical Office and was in charge of the first Polish census, the first census of the Second Polish Republic, which was declared at the end of the First World War. But Grossman didn't just take up a professional job. He also joined the Communist Workers' Party of Poland. He became a communist. He played a role in the educational activities of the Communist Party. That much is clear from a variety of sources. He may well have played other roles as well. The KPRP was an underground organisation almost from the beginning, so it's hard to know a lot of details about people's activities. But he was a committed member of the Polish Communist Workers' Party.
So there was a direct connection between his economic work and his political organizing? Was there an idea that linked those two things?
Indeed, Ashley, there was. And that is via something that Lenin said in a couple of places, which is that there is no hopeless situation. There are no hopeless situations for the capitalist class. Revolutionary situations definitely arise, but they are not of themselves hopeless. And Grossman quotes this in a couple of places. His big book, The Law of Accumulation, and also in an essay that sort of cleared the way for that book, a critique of a book called Imperialism by Fritz Sternberg, and Grossman's review appeared in 1928. And Grossman's argument is that the tendency for capitalism to break down is an important generator of economic crises. The way in which those crises are resolved depends on the extent to which the working class is effectively organized around revolutionary politics. It's in economic crises, Grossman argues, that revolutionary organization can be used to achieve a successful revolution. Revolutions can't be just conjured out of thin air. There has to be a crisis for the ruling class. Now, the crisis may or may not be an economic one, but Grossman argued that that economic crises can create the situations in which revolutionary action can be most effective and revolutionary organization can be most effective, because in economic crises it becomes very obvious to vast numbers of people that capitalism is not delivering the goods, and large numbers of people look around for an alternative. Mm. And that alternative, if revolutionary socialists are effectively organized, is their politics rather than the politics of the far right, who do offer an alternative to the mainstream conventional solutions, or for that matter, the politics of the extreme center, apparent outsiders who portray themselves as offering a different path from the mainstream center left or center right. And here, in contemporary terms, I'm thinking about people like Macron in France, or the Five Star Movement in Italy, who say that they are something different, but actually represent a form of continuity.
So crisis leads to political organizing, because we look at the world and, well, we can't feed ourselves. So people will people will of necessity begin to say, well, maybe we should organize things differently. But it doesn't have to go in a progressive direction. Is that what you're saying?
That's right. I wouldn't say that crisis leads to political organization. I think it's a bit late to try and organize a mass revolutionary party in the midst of a profound social and or economic crisis. I think that the work needs to start earlier. It's in the course of a social or economic crisis that political organizations can find a far wider audience and grow massively, so that the prospects of revolution become not only possible, because revolutions happen even without revolutionary organizations, revolutions can become possible in an economic crisis, but also the chance of them being successful, the chance of the working class conquering political power and holding on to it will be vastly greater if there is a coherent revolutionary organisation. And the Grossman, the example that Grossman looked to, of course, was the Bolshevik Party, which became the Russian Communist Party. And I think that despite the degeneration of the Russian Revolution in the course of the 1930s, that approach to achieving social change and to ensuring that revolutions, when they occur, are sustained and successful, that lesson is still an important one, and it complements Grossman's recovery of Marx's theory of economic crisis. And in fact, Grossman clearly thought of himself as a Leninist. He looked to Lenin as providing leadership for him, education for him in the realm of politics. And he also fairly clearly was influenced by Georgi Lukács in the realm of philosophy. There's a bit more about Lenin in Grossman than there is about Lukács, but you can see the traces of Lukács's conceptions in some of Grossman's work.
Okay, that's interesting. I want to come back to that. And I also want to come back to what Grossman thought of the Soviet Union. But I wanted to just unpick a little bit the tendency of the rate of profit to fall. So I was talking about this with a friend of mine who's gone rogue, used to be a Marxist and has gone over to the dark side and has became interested in Austrian economics and now is a Randian. But anyways, he was saying it doesn't matter about the rate of profit because all the capitalist is interested in is the massive profit.
The rate of profit can fall lower and lower and lower. So long as it's not zero, capitalists will keep on investing. Well, yeah, Grossman thought about this too. The thing is that as capitalism develops, as the process of capital accumulation proceeds, the minimum amount of capital that you need to engage in production and to sustain production and to expand production increases. The outlays that you have to make in order to establish a steelworks today vastly dwarf the kind of outlays that would have been necessary in the early 19th century, or for that matter, early in the 20th century. So that increase in the minimum amount of capital that you need to engage in a competitive enterprise means that if the rate of profit falls too low, you're not going to be able to accumulate enough surplus value in order to maintain your outlays. So that's very important. And it raises a significant issue that Grossman also highlighted and had, like the tendency of for the rate of profit to fall, being neglected in the previous Marxist literature, but which pervaded Marx's own writings, in particular pervaded his work on capital and theories of surplus value. And it's this. It's the distinction between use value and exchange value. Well, you might say every Marxist textbook starts off with the distinction between use value, the way in which the stuff of life actually has a purpose and a function, we put it to some sort of use. For something to be a commodity, it has to have a use. Human beings have to be able to employ it in some way that, in order to achieve something that they want, whether it's immediate pleasure or the accumulation of capital in the case of the use value of a machine tool or whatever. Commodities also have a value that is determined by the amount of labor that has gone into producing them. And the surface appearance of that value Marx calls exchange value. And that surface appearance transmogrifies in the course of capital, which moves from quite an abstract level of analysis, dealing with the most important elements of capitalism as a system, and abstracting away from less important ones. It moves from that abstract level to a more and more concrete level of analysis in the course of the volumes of capital. And that process of concretization, an aspect of that is the emergence of price, which deviates from exchange value. Well, we won't go on to it, into that at this stage anyway. It's also worth noting that Grossman was the first to systematically identify Marx's method in Capital, although Marx himself had written about it, and that is the movement from the abstract to the concrete in the course of the book, the making of heroic simplifying assumptions at the start of the analysis, assumptions which are progressively lifted, and therefore the analysis is concretized in the course of the analysis. Okay, so we've got use value and exchange value, and that's in the first chapter of Capital. What Grossman identified was the way in which that twofold nature of commodities, as useful things and as things that have a value, ultimately determined by the amount of labour that's gone into their production, or the socially necessary labour that's gone into their production, he identified the way in which that pervaded the whole of Capital. And the example that I gave before of needing to outlay larger and larger amounts to initiate or sustain production as capitalism develops and matures, that has to do with both the exchange value and the use value aspects of means of production. Those means of production change their form, change their concrete material form, and that material form is an important aspect of the accumulation process. Between Marx and Grossman, historically between Marx and Grossman, that importance of use value at all sorts of levels in Capital, in Marx's book Capital, had been thoroughly neglected. Grossman documents the way in which it's important for the analysis. And that's something that he deals with in a number of his writings, including The Law of Accumulation, but also in a book called Marx, Classical Political Economy and the Problem of Dynamics, a monograph which is a translation of which I have made, which has been now published three times, once as a sort of a pamphlet, once in a collection of Grossman's longer works issued by Haymarket Books, and again in the first volume of Grossman's works, the first of four volumes of Grossman's works, which I'm editing. It was published again last November.
So this is also in Capital Volume 3, Chapter 13, is it not? Or it's somewhere in those first 13 chapters when he lays out the tendency of the rate of profit to fall, and he mentions this massive profit versus rate of profit. Is this the answer that he gives there? I think I'm having trouble grasping why the distinction between use value and exchange value leads to the need to outlay larger and larger amounts on means of production.
It's because the material form of constant capital changes, and the units in which constant capital are measured are not arbitrary. Like, you cannot outlay money, accumulated surplus value, on half of a steelworks or half of an oxygen furnace and expect it to work. You need to have the whole thing, because it only functions as a use value if you have the whole thing. So the material form in which commodities, and in particular here we're talking about constant capital, the material form that it takes is important.
Oh,
and
I
can't
see.
Be abstracted away from. You can't just say, well, we've only got a little bit of surplus value. We'll invest in a quarter of an oxygen furnace and then expect to be able to generate further surplus value by getting workers to operate a quarter of an oxygen furnace.
So to get into the market, it takes a huge amount of investment, because you have to, at that point in the development of technology, you have to buy the whole humongous factory and so on. So if the rate of profit is really low, there's no incentive, or if like the return that you can expect, so long as it's not zero is the argument, that will encourage people to invest. But if it's such a small return on investment, nobody's going to buy this humongous factory unless they're like a philanthropist or something and they're just doing it out of the kindness of their heart. So what winds up happening is that capitalists don't invest as much in production anymore. There's less and less incentive to create new value.
Yeah, exactly. And what you have is what was pretty apparent in the lead up to the global financial crisis, from which there hasn't yet been a full recovery, and something which is apparent at various stages in the history of capitalism, and that is capitalists shying away from investing in production that actually generates new surplus value and deciding instead to invest in scare quotes in speculative activity on share markets or various kinds of arcane financial instruments, which are ultimately a form of financial roulette. And that's still a problem, the level of investment in productive forms of outlay still is deficient. It's improved because the global financial crisis led to a devaluation of significant chunks of capital, but nevertheless there are still problems with the rate of profit. Hence, according to a variety of studies, the recovery since the global financial crisis has been a particularly weak one.
Because at the end of the day, the profit that comes from all of these complex financial instruments, regardless of how it's calculated or generated or why you win as much, is ultimately it depends on actual labor performed by workers. Is that right?
Exactly right. That's precisely the case. Yeah.
So if you're not investing in actual labor performed by actual workers, what you're doing is you're kind of trying to steal or like appropriate all of this surplus value that is just dwindling?
Or is it a stagnant kind of a level? So it's about transferring surplus value amongst different players.
Apple is not a technology company, it's not a software company, and it sure as heck not a smartphone company. Let me show you a statistic. Apple's market share is 13.7%. It's not a half, a quarter, or even a sixth of the smartphone market. In fact, Samsung has a relatively larger market share than Apple, almost 50% more than Apple. So considering that Apple has a relatively small market share compared to its $900 billion valuation, some of you might be scratching your heads, but we're missing an important fact. While Apple has only 13.7% of the smartphone market, it has an absolutely colossal 91% of the profit of the smartphone market in 2016. Looking back to Samsung, there is no comparison, as it is outclassed in almost every way.
So then this leads to crisis, because ultimately people will demand to be paid, but there isn't anything really to pay them?
It leads to crisis because the rate of investment in productive activity declines to such an extent that overall expenditure diminishes. And if you're not investing in new productive activity, or if you're not replacing the constant capital that's worn out sufficiently, then there'll be problems in those industries that are producing means of production. Workers will be laid off in those industries, and those workers won't be purchasing commodities because they won't be purchasing as many commodities as before. So the effect of the crisis in that sector rolls on to other sectors of the commodity economy, including sectors that are producing consumer goods.
Okay, so how, I think I've got this now. I think the little bits of gaps in my understanding are being filled. How does devaluation as a kind, as a countervailing tendency, how does that lead to the getting out of crisis, or can it ultimately lead to overcoming crises?
What we talked about before, if a corporation goes bankrupt or a firm goes bankrupt and sells off its means of production at a discount, then those means of production can be set to in operation by the same number of workers as before. But the overall outlays of the capitalist who has purchased those devalued means of production are lower than the outlays of the now bankrupt capitalist. So the amount of surplus value produced can be the same, but it's measured against lower outlays on constant plus variable capital. In other words, the rate of profit has increased, and therefore the incentive to engage in further accumulation has improved.
I was reading Andrew Kleinman's book. I can't remember which one it was now, but I think it was the Myth of Inconsistency book, but I could be wrong. But anyways, he says in
the Failure of Capitalist Production.
Yes, I think that's the one. And he mentions that war is another way of devaluing, if I've got that right. So is a potential outcome of the tendency of the rate of profit to fall war? And how does that happen?
Well, I think there are two issues there. The first is the war just actually physically destroying constant capital, and therefore there being less constant capital in the world compared with employed labour power, and that increasing profitability. That's one question. The other question is, how does capitalism lead to war? The fact that war has the consequence, or can have the consequence, if it doesn't wipe us all off the face of the planet, of improving profit rates, doesn't mean that that is the cause of war. The teleological argument. I think the cause of war is capitalist competition. The effort by capitalists to accumulate at the expense of their rivals, and the way in which capitalist states sponsor capitals that are based within their territory and seek to promote their accumulation as opposed to the accumulation of capitals based in other territories. And it's that competition amongst capitals, and therefore amongst states, that I think is something that ultimately generates war. Of course, there are all sorts of intermediary issues to do with strategic military considerations as well, but what underpins them is capitalist competition on a global scale.
Okay, so how did Grossman's work stand up to the criticisms that were being launched against Marx's work at the time, in particular the charge of inconsistency? Was he aware of that? Did he respond to it?
Well, Grossman did write on the so-called transformation problem, which is where the argument about inconsistency particularly comes to the fore. And that is the argument that Marx starts talking about values and then ends up in volume 3 of Capital talking about prices of production which are closer to market prices. And the argument that was made by von Böhm, Bawerk, and various others, including people in who identified themselves as Marxists, notably, well, for a while at least, Borkowitz, they argued that, well, there's nothing that necessarily connects values with prices, that the way in which Marx conducts the transformation from values through prices of production to prices is mistaken. And that transformation, Marx makes an argument about the transformation in the third volume of Capital, and that argument really came into the Anglo literature in a big way through through Sweezy. And the solution that was offered was a dual systems theory, arguing that you needed two sets of simultaneous equations to resolve this problem. In his book on the transformation, Andrew Kleiman very, very effectively documents the debate about inconsistency in Marx and the supposed inadequacy of Marx's transformation mechanism. Grossman did write about this. He had some observations that are relevant, but he didn't address head-on the question of the transformation. I think that that has now been very effectively dealt with by the proponents of what's known in the trade as single system. Now I've forgotten it.
Temporal single system interpretation.
That's the one of which Andrew Kleiman is a proponent, and also the work of Fred Moseley, which I see as a kind of a variant of the Kleiman kind of approach, although Kleiman doesn't see it that way. So I think the issue has been resolved after, well, a very long period of time, and resolved in a way that elucidates Marx's analysis, makes sense of Marx's analysis of the transformation, and ultimately vindicates his account of the transformation.
So Grossman's work was more empirical and rather than sort of launching into debates at that were going on at that time. Is that right?
No, I wouldn't say. Certainly there's a large amount of empirical material. Some of it I'm going through at the moment in editing his Law of Accumulation and trying to track down and check a lot of his sources. There's a lot of empirical material there, but his arguments are fundamentally theoretical arguments against critiques of Marx's positions that are both theoretical critiques and at the same time empirical critiques, saying Marx's argument is wrong and it's proved to be wrong by the fact that things haven't turned out the way Marx said that they would. Well, Grossman defends Marx on both counts. He argues that Marx was consistent, that Marx was coherent, that his arguments hold water in a logical sense, and also that we can see Marx's analysis, or Marx's analysis can be vindicated by developments in the real world. So there's a lot of empirical material, but that's illustrative of a theoretical argument in Grossman's work, paralleling Marx's own approach in Capital.
Okay, and you mentioned that some of his work was related to Otto Bauer's reproduction schemes. Could you say a little bit more about that? Is that not where profit eventually goes to zero if you carry it on far enough?
Essentially, the reproduction schemes are essentially models of capitalist accumulation, setting out numerically. It can also be set out in a more abstract way, setting out numerically examples of how much is invested in constant capital, how much is invested in variable capital, how much surplus value results, and then how that surplus value is invested in constant and variable capital or consumed by the capitalist class. And Otto Bauer, in his critique of Rosa Luxemburg's essentially under-consumptionist argument, saying that capitalism would inevitably break down because there were insufficient means of realizing surplus value, that is, of selling everything that was produced. And just a bracket here, Rosa Luxemburg is an important reference point for Henrik Grossman. He provides a devastating critique of her theory of economic crisis and breakdown, but in doing that, he recognizes that she identified the tendency to breakdown and the tendency to crisis as a crucial aspect of Marx's theory. And Grossman celebrates her for maintaining that aspect of Marx's theory. And it's really extremely important, not only in a theoretical sense, but in a practical sense. That is, the argument that capitalism is inherently crisis prone, that it inherently tends towards breakdown. This is a position which reformists, including reformists who identify themselves as Marxists or social democrats who identify themselves as Marxists, cannot really accept. And that explains one of the sides in the critique of Grossman's work, right from the moment that it was published in the first round of reviews, and the book was very, very widely reviewed. We can go perhaps later into how there was another broadside against Grossman's explanation, and I would argue Marx's explanation of economic crisis and the tendency to break down, and that critique came from Stalinists. But back to...
What was the significance of Otto Bauer's work?
Right. Otto Bauer developed his reproduction schemas to show that Rosa Luxemburg's under-consumption theory was wrong, that it was possible for capitalism to grow proportionately, and for all of the output of a closed capitalist model to be realized and for accumulation to continue. And he did that reasonably successfully. He did it through, I think it was five cycles of his model, making assumptions about the rate of reinvestment in constant and variable capital, the rate of new investment in constant and variable capital. What Grossman did sometime around 1922, 1923, maybe a little bit later, was he continued Bauer's reproduction scheme and realized that eventually it breaks down.
Wasn't it in like 34 years or something like that?
36. In 36 years, Bauer's own model breaks down. And that analysis really inspired Grossman's account of the breakdown tendency.
It's really fascinating the way that he describes it. I can't remember the name of the paper now, but this was the first paper that I read of Grossman's that really amazed me, because like after a certain point, you know, something obviously has to happen, because capitalists aren't going to keep investing if they're not going to consume anything themselves, never mind the fact that they have to put so much back into production. And it really tells us something about the world, you know, that you can see this kind of happening. After a little while, something's got to give.
That's right. That's right. Other things being equal, of course.
Right.
That is, if the counter tendencies don't come into play.
Well, like that's the idea
Marx
that the
Grossman argued is that in the medium to long term, the counter tendencies tend to weaken, and the tendency for the rate of profit to fall becomes predominant.
Yeah, exactly. That it just makes it so obvious that these counter tendencies, you can see them coming into play in the world, you know, because obviously this can't happen. You can't have the rate of profit going to zero.
Yeah, so bosses and the state engage in actions that are designed to increase the rate of profit. And, well, the whole neoliberal project is about increasing the rate of profit by trying to rein in state expenditures. That hasn't been so successful, but also in trying to increase the rate of surplus value in order, in other words, to hold down wages, to push them further down in order that an increased amount of surplus value accrues to the bosses. And also in terms of the imperialist exploits of the major capitalist powers to try and render their military and economic might into a means of extracting surplus value from other parts of the world.
So I find this really, my students laugh at me because I get very excited about ideas that seem to them to be very arcane. But I find this extremely fascinating and explanatory of our present moment and a propeller for political organizing. Like, you can kind of see that there's this world of you know, wealth just in the future, because throughout this whole process, what's being created is lots and lots of use values, you know, stuff that we can use as workers, as human beings. But then there's the contradiction where the thing that propels the creation of those use values, that is profit, is declining, and there's less and less incentive to create those things.
And those things are created not to satisfy human needs.
Exactly, yeah.
But in order to make profit.
But then just beyond the horizon, we can kind of see that if you have like a fully automated factory, that's really quite bad for capitalism, if I'm not mistaken, but really quite good for workers. Because then you don't have to do anything.
Well,
or you,
yes,
you got like a 3D printer.
I think that we're still some very significant distance away from that, despite the musings of various technophiles and so on. But
I think I may be one of those. I realize it.
Well, I think it's something to look forward to. And given that the priority in capitalist society is the creation of profit, not the satisfaction of human need, that means that there is very little priority given to the minimization of human labor, the making of that labor more creative, the involvement of workers in the direction of that labor. That those aren't considerations. Things are invested in if they improve profits. Not just consumers, but also for workers themselves.
I find that really annoying, actually, because when this conversation comes up and people talk about technological advancement, and they can kind of see in the future that there may be some time where the labor that goes into creating things is very, very low, and they go, gosh, what will we do with ourselves? As though that's the problem. No, the problem isn't that we'll be bored. That's the least of our worries. The problem is that we have a system in which that can't happen, because in order to buy those use values, you need to be engaged in the labor process. So the point of all of this productive capacity isn't to free us and to give us more time. It's to increase productivity and thereby increase profit.
That's absolutely right. But
we won't have any more free time. We'll work just as hard.
Well,
if not harder.
Yeah, I mean, another aspect of capitalist production, and this is something that Marx already wrote about in an embryonic form in the 1844 manuscript, is the way in which human beings are of their nature creative. We need to engage in creative labor. But labor under capitalism is labor which is controlled by the capitalist, not by the worker. The worker's creativity is subordinated to the production of profit, and workers have little or no control over the process of production. I think an aspect of a socialist society in transition to communism and communism itself will not be designed to eliminate work, but rather to make work fulfilling and creative for those who engage in it, rather than something that is alienating in the sense that workers don't control the production process, that their relations with other people in the production process is alienated, they are forced into competition with each other, and the way in which the product that is generated at work doesn't belong to workers individually or collectively, but works that belongs to the capitalist. So, I don't have anything against labour per se. What I've got something against is capitalist labour for the capitalist class, labour for the production of profit, something which workers are constrained to do not because of their human nature, their need to be creative, but rather because if they don't do this non-creative labour in the sense of fulfilling themselves, they starve.
Yeah, see, that's good. That's interesting, because I was putting all of my hope in alienation ending when, you know, alienation as the separation of your creativity from the product, when we had the technology, which seems to be, you know, actually available now, where you just kind of think it, and then you can make it. You know, you can have a 3D printer, and I keep going on about 3D printers. They're not the wonderful thing that I'm making them out to be. But, you know, I'm thinking like, you know, Star Trek, where you can just think it and say, like, computer, give me a hamburger. You know what I mean? And then that's the end of alienation. But what you're saying is that it's long before that. It's taking control of the productive process so that our labor, the labor that we do anyway, is controlled by us. And that would be a form of ending alienation long before we're on the Star Trek Enterprise.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's something that is possible now. And it's a form of control, of course, that would be a collective control, a control not against other workers under capitalism. Workers are pushed to compete with each other for jobs and for wages, but rather a control alongside other people through discussion, through debate, and possibly democratic mechanisms deciding, well, what are we going to do? How are we going to tackle this particular issue in production? What's the best way of satisfying our needs and the needs of the other people who are going to consume the products that we are engaged in making?
Do you think, so this sort of brings us back to the question I want to ask you about Grossman's support for the USSR. So, you know, a critic might say that, well, the USSR kind of tried to do that, and it was this horrible failure. They were using, like, production prices that they stole from capitalists to figure out how much something should cost and so on. So how...
Yeah, planning, yeah.
Yeah, so how would we get over that? Is it a matter of if the USSR just had the internet, all would be well?
Well, I think that workers did take power in Russia in 1917, and they did so through a revolution that placed hands in extremely democratic institutions, vastly more democratic institutions than those of bourgeois parliamentary democracy that you and I enjoy. And those institutions were called Soviets, which are workers' councils. That occurred in a relatively backward capitalist country. And it was, and the revolution was led by the Bolsheviks as a kind of a wager. And this was a wager that Stalin, at one stage, himself acknowledged. And it was a wager that the revolution could spread from relatively backward Russia, where maybe 5% of the population were workers and the vast bulk were peasants. The wager was that the revolution would spread to far more developed capitalist countries, mm-hmm. in particular Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And this was something that wasn't a ridiculous idea, because what ended the First World War was revolutions in Central Europe. There was revolution in Germany, and from 1918 until 1923, the political situation in Germany was extremely unstable, and there were a number of occasions when revolution seemed to be possible. For a number of reasons, including the misleadership of the Communist International by those who came to lead it, including Zinoviev and eventually Stalin and Bukharin, that potential was not realised in Germany. And likewise, somewhat later on, where revolution broke out in China in 1926-1927, the misleadership of the Communist International played an important role in the defeat of workers' power in China as well. What I'd argue is that and this is essentially a Trotskyist argument, that the isolation of the Russian Revolution doomed it to failure, mm-hmm. but that isolation was not something preordained. It was something that was a consequence of the defeat of workers' struggles in a series of different countries. So, by the end of the 1920s, there were no vestiges of workers' power at all. The counter-revolution had been successful. Its figurehead and dictator was Stalin. Adding the internet to Stalin does not equal socialism, because socialism is not possible without workers' power, without workers' democracy, without control by the working class. Socialist revolution is the self-emancipation of the working class, and that self-emancipation can only be sustained, that emancipation can only be sustained, and working class rule can only be a reality, that is, rule by the working class, if there are democratic institutions through which the will of the working class can be articulated. A dictatorship cannot do that. So, yeah, it wouldn't have been okay if we'd had the internet in 1928 when the first five-year plan was formulated.
Would it make a difference now?
I think it makes planning on any kind of a level, including a global level, a much more straightforward proposition. Not only the internet, but also the kind of computing power that we have today would make democratic planning, not arbitrary decision-making imposed by coercion from above, which was what the Soviet five-year plans were about, and therefore, because they were imposed from above, they couldn't really be planning, because nobody really knew the capacities of different enterprises and the productive abilities of workers, because it was in everybody's interests to conceal that. Today, making the calculations to coordinate productive activity across countries, continents, internationally is far more straightforward than it would have been if the Russian Revolution had spread across Europe and then skipped the Atlantic, so that the so-called Seattle Soviet had just been a forerunner for workers' power in the United States.
I wanted to ask about the Frankfurt School, because Grossman was an early member of that group. Am I right?
I'd phrase it slightly differently. Mm. The Frankfurt School is an intellectual current, which is associated with Horkheimer and Adorno preeminently, other people as well, a current that continued to develop after the Second World War. Grossman did not belong to that intellectual current as it developed from really the Dialectic of Enlightenment, which is sort of a semi-founding document. Grossman belonged to an organization, to the Institute for Social Research, Institut für Sozialforschung, which was attached to the university in Frankfurt am Main. So he had very good relations with other members of the Institute, and that is apparent in correspondence that he maintained with other members of the Institute, particularly after the Institute was dispersed by the Nazis being handed power by conservative politicians and the German ruling class in 1933. Grossman went to Paris. Other members of the Institute went initially to Switzerland and then ended up in the United States, where they established themselves. And Grossman corresponded with them in the period when he was not in the same place as them. He went from Paris to London and eventually ended up in New York. And in that correspondence, it's very clear that he has quite tender feelings for a number of the other members of the Institute. And he was very sympathetic to Max Horkheimer's philosophical work during the 1930s. And that work was much more in a classical Marxist kind of a tradition than his subsequent work, which I think represented a departure from historical materialism. And that departure is especially signaled by the book, The Dialectic of Enlightenment by Horkheimer and Adorno. Grossman, going back to the question of the Soviet Union, Grossman was a committed communist. He wasn't a member of the German Communist Party, essentially because he was in exile from Poland and his situation in Germany was somewhat tenuous, so he was careful. But it was very clear that he was a fellow traveller of the KPD, of the German Communist Party. And like so many other committed communists, he had a lot invested in a commitment to the Soviet Union, and was not aware of or perhaps rationalized the degeneration of the revolution in the course of the 1920s. However, the moronic policies of the Communist International in the face of Hitler, the so-called third period policies, which involved deeming social democrats to be social fascists and as bad as or worse than the Italian fascists or the Nazis, making collaboration and cooperation in the fight against fascism extremely difficult. That idiocy, of course, paralleled by the sectarianism of the social democrats as well, that third period idiocy, that obstacle to a serious united front policy, led Grossman to wake up. And he recognized in 1933 that things were very seriously amiss with the KPD and the advice and instructions that the KPD was getting from Moscow. He became quite critical, and in Paris, he certainly was involved with a number of dissident communists in the Communist Party opposition organization, which was actually outside the Communist Party. So he was quite critical. At one stage, he recommended a work by Trotsky to Paul Matic, an article that Trotsky had written that I think was, I forget where it was published. Grossman's position shifted again later in the 1930s under the impact of the Spanish Civil War. He had at least one chum in Spain, possibly other people. He made a trip to Spain during summer holidays while he was living in Paris. And he basically flipped back to uncritical support of the Soviet Union and the general line of the Communist International, on the basis that while no other countries supported the Popular Front government, the Republican government in Spain against Franco's counter-revolutionary coup, the Soviet Union did so, or at least seemed to do so. He took that at face value. In fact, the Communist International, the Soviet Union, and the Spanish Communist Party and its Catalonian branch played a counter-revolutionary role, I'd argue, in Spain. But Grossman had an emotional response to developments in Spain and became, again, a fairly uncritical supporter of the Soviet Union. However, he did not abandon his own approach to economic theory, and his conception of workers' power, even though in practice the organisations that he identified with were now counter-revolutionary. And perhaps this is the point when I can say something about the other critics, the other Marxist, in scare quotes, critics of Grossman's crisis theory and his theory of breakdown, and that is the critics from the Stalinist perspective, who were very hostile to Grossman's book, The Law of Accumulation, and the theory that was articulated in it. And they were hostile because Grossman's analysis did not concur with the Stalinist orthodoxy, an orthodoxy formulated by Stalin's lieutenant in economics, a guy called Eugen or Yeno or Eugene Varga. He was a Hungarian in exile after the defeat of the Hungarian Revolution in 1919, a Hungarian in exile in Moscow, an economist, a former social democrat, and then communist, who basically Stalin anointed to establish the line in economics. And essentially, Varga was, without acknowledging it, a vulgarizer of Rosa Luxemburg's positions. He didn't acknowledge the source of his approach in Luxembourg, because Luxembourg was vilified by the Communist International and in the German Communist Party on a couple of occasions. As in other matters, the Communist International, the Russian Communist Party, under Stalin's leadership, established a line in economics. And if you didn't agree with that line, well, then your positions were suspect. You were counter-revolutionary or petty bourgeois or a social democrat. And that was the label that was, the calumny that was attributed to Grossman, recapitulating the social democratic myth that Grossman had a mechanical theory of breakdown that saw no role for the working class.
And was this during Grossman's lifetime?
Well, this was straight after his book was published.
Oh.
Varga wrote two reviews of Grossman's book. There were multiple reviews in Russian, many reviews in German, some reviews in French, not sure that there were any reviews in English. I mean, Grossman was introduced to an English-speaking audience, to a large English-speaking audience, really by Sweezy, but in a way that distorted Grossman's position. So the response by social democrats and Stalinists to Grossman's, the publication of Grossman's book, Contemporary Reviews, were overwhelmingly, well, no, not overwhelmingly, entirely hostile from social democrats and Stalinists, which of course, they were the main currents inside the labor movement. There was some sympathy for Grossman's position amongst certain council communists, notably Paul Matic, but some others as well. And Paul Matic argued in favour of Grossman's position eventually in English as well. Mm. By this stage, Matic had been in the States from the 1920s onwards. But Matic's audience in the United States was very, very small. And there were other council communists, notably one of the most prominent, Dutch Marxist Anton Pennekoek. Pennekoek actually seems to have plagiarized some of the Varga's criticisms of Grossman.
So Grossman strikes me as a kind of Enlightenment figure, you know, like, you know, if Marx was the tail end of the Enlightenment, Grossman's very much within that kind of way of thinking. How were his ideas received by the Institute for Social Research, who had by that point begun to question the Enlightenment?
Well, the initial reception was quite friendly. The Institute was, the initial director of the Institute was a guy called Karl Grunberg, an Austrian economic historian, historian of the labor movement and economist, who Grossman had studied in Vienna. And it was Grunberg who became the director of the Institute in 1925, who gave Grossman a job in Frankfurt am Main as his assistant at the Institute, providing Grossman with a rather cushy job. That the Institute was a great place for Marxist researchers to work when Grossman was in exile from Poland. And when Horkheimer took over at the beginning of the 1930s because Grunberg had a stroke, you know, relations remained friendly, and there was a continuing respect for Grossman's analysis amongst the principals of the Institute. And that continued after the war with Horkheimer and Adorno, but they saw Grossman's critique of capitalism as being a sort of an imminent critique that was subsidiary to their own essentially philosophical critique of capitalism and modernity. There was a break between Grossman and Horkheimer, who was the director of the Institute, in the early 1940s, and it was precipitated by a number of factors. I think the most interesting factor is the movement of Horkheimer with Adorno, who Horkheimer had selected as the best, the most promising collaborator in the development of his own work. They're moving away from Marxism. They're moving away from historical materialism towards an allegorical, abstract miserabilism or pessimism. So that there's that. I mean, that's a significant theoretical difference. And in their critique of the Enlightenment, they became critical of certain kinds of empirical work, not the highly empirical work that the members of the Institute undertook, including that for the studies in the authoritarian personality and so on. But Horkheimer, in an assessment of a draft of a very valuable long article by Grossman, two-part article by Grossman on the evolutionist revolt against classical economics. Horkheimer accused Grossman of basically being an empiricist because he made arguments that drew on the material empirical world. But, of course, Horkheimer and Adorno even do this in the Dialectic of Enlightenment. So that's the
basically that he was trying to uncover some kind of law of movement. So he was a positivist.
Yes, that's right. That's right. He was trying to make sense of the logic of capital accumulation, and well, you know, that's in the eyes of Horkheimer, this was obviously empiricism.
So was some of his work not consciously suppressed as well? I thought that I had read that there was something that he wrote that had stayed hidden in files for quite some time.
The monograph that I mentioned, the Marx Classical Political Economy and the Problem of Dynamics, Grossman had initially proposed as a work to go into the Institute's journal, Zeitschrift für Sozialforschung, the Journal for Social Research, on a Marx anniversary in 1937. But Grossman, he became more ambitious in what he was trying to do in the essay, and it grew in size. And then it was drafted and redrafted. Eventually, the journal of the Institute was being published in Paris by Alcan, and you may remember that the German Wehrmacht invaded France, which created problems for the publication of the journal. So that slowed things down as well. And eventually, there were delays in publishing the work, which became a small monograph rather than a long article. And Grossman issued an ultimatum saying, look, if this thing isn't published by the Institute, then I'll go public about you suppressing it. This was, you know, once the break had effectively occurred for theoretical reasons, and for political reasons, Grossman had become effectively a Stalinist in politics, whereas the other members of the Institute, well, most of the other members at least, were very critical of the Soviet Union. And also there was a financial aspect as well. The other economist, the other prominent economist, a guy called Fritz Pollock, who was a childhood friend of Horkheimer's, and who effectively became the administrative head of the Institute, fucked up the Institute's investments so that its resources dramatically diminished when the global and US economy turned down again around 1937. And in order to sustain his own comfort and capacity to bestow upon the world his own insightful analyses, Horkheimer and Pollock instituted a process of cutting the salaries of other members of the Institute and driving them out. And that included sort of personal terror methods of, you know, being nasty to members of the Institute. And Pollock was apparently very nasty to Grossman at some function. So that's the third aspect of the break. Eventually, the Institute does publish in German Marx Classical Political Economy and the Problem of Dynamics, but it's in an erroneoed or gestetnered form. And that was effectively salvaged by a section of the German New Left, which went back to look for works that were worth republishing. And they republished works by Horkheimer, essays that he wasn't keen on republishing after the war from the 1930s, which were, you know, essentially Marxist kinds of essays in philosophy. But also Grossman's, a variety of Grossman's works were republished, and they found this particular publication. I assume they found the copy that is in the library of the University in Frankfurt and mine, of which I have a photocopy, and they reset it and issued at that stage, and it's only really then that it became widely available, at least in German. It's been translated into English on three occasions, which I think is an indication of its significance as a work, because it provides insights into the relationship between use value and exchange value, and offers an original and important critique of mainstream economics, what is just called economics in universities today, which is technically neoclassical economics, as ahistorical. And Grossman foreshadows the temporal single system critique of previous solutions to the transformation problem. The TSS critique is that those solutions are simultaneous and don't take into account change over time, history. Well, Grossman had a critique of mainstream economics back before neoclassical economics, actually, to the classical economics of Ricardo and Smith, and also an approach that had been imported into the previous, or much of the previous, Marxist economic literature.
Yeah, that's something I'd like to get into. Maybe if we have another conversation somewhere down the road, the criticism of marginalism, I find fascinating.
Sure.
But I think, so I tend to think that the suppression or the reception of Grossman's ideas by people like Horkheimer, who were moving more toward cultural criticism at that time, I tend to think that this is symbolic of what's happened on the left generally, that figures like Grossman are seen as, you know, emblems of the past, that they're obsessively positivist, searching for laws. And we don't really do that anymore. It seems to me that the left is really interested, or has been really interested, in cultural criticism for quite a long time. So I tend to think, I like this story of the Frankfurt School and its relationship with Grossman, because it seems to me symbolic of the path taken by leftist politics since then. But you disagree with that, I think. What do you think?
Well, I think what you describe is an accurate depiction of the academic left since the late 70s. Or the early 1980s. I think that that's accurate, that the cultural term. However, that is not the left. The left is vastly larger than what goes on in academia, and a great deal of what happens in the outside world is not terribly influenced by what goes on in the culture, in the ruminations of the cultural analysis by the left in universities. And the left these days is still predominantly social democratic. There are still remnants of Stalinism, theoretical approaches, if not in glorification of the Soviet Union or of North Korea or Vietnam or Cuba. Those are still significant elements in perspectives on political practice on the left today. And I'd argue that those traditions are still pretty significant.
I think
Stop, you go on.
Oh, I was going to say, I think it might be my a reflection of where I am situated. So academia plus internet. And I have a slight inkling that there's a life outside the internet, but
I'm sure you have more than inkling. Yeah.
So when you just look at like Twitter, you get this deep sinking feeling that it's all
the
way forward is cultural criticism.
What you say about the cultural left in universities, I think, has had some repercussions beyond the academy, particularly in relation to identity politics, which has played identity politics as opposed to the struggle against oppressions of a myriad kinds, identity politics, I think, was incubated in academia and has had a pernicious effect beyond academia as well, to the extent that elements of right-wing social democracy and even of conservative politics have appropriated aspects of identity politics in order to shut down and divide those that emphasise the importance of class and the importance of solidarity and the importance of identifying the foundations of both exploitation and oppressions in the dynamic of capitalism.
Absolutely. I thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. I'll just have one more question. Beside the theory of economic crisis, what else did Grossman have to offer?
He identifies Marx's method in capital in a systematic way. That's important. That was a breakthrough. He goes through the way in which use value is a factor in the dynamic of economies beyond the constitution of the commodity as described in Volume 1 of Capital. That's important. He's also somebody who had contradictory ideas in his head. So on the one hand, he was a political supporter of the Soviet Union again from around 1936-1937. He joins when he returns to Europe from the United States, from New York. He goes to a job in Leipzig and he joins the Sozialistische Einheitspartei, the Socialist Unity Party, which is the Communist Party of Eastern Germany. But at the same time, he is also, at least intellectually, committed to the idea that socialism is about the working class liberating itself. And he sees a connection between that and his analysis of economic crisis. So, yes, he had contradictory ideas. I think ideas that on closer analysis are incompatible. But he held fast to his important breakthroughs. And you know, maybe this has something to do with his personality, because I don't think that he was a modest person. He was a self-confident guy who was brought up, who went to an elite school, well, actually all secondary schools, effectively, in Poland when he was at school were elite. He went to a grammar school in Poland. He absorbed some of the values of upper-class Polish society in terms of self-confidence and an idea of chivalry and so on. So he just wasn't prepared to dump his ideas, even though they were denounced in the official organs of the German Communist Party and the official organ of the Communist International, theoretical organ of the Communist International. He held fast to those ideas that were a product of his political development before the influence of Stalinism.